I'm Aaron Henkin, and this is Midday. For 9 years, Urbanite magazine was a unique voice in the Baltimore media landscape. Its mission, stated proudly, was to focus unabashedly on Baltimore City and its many possibilities, to be a magazine for people who love Baltimore and who don't shirk from her demanding side. After 98 issues, the free monthly magazine folded, but today, the publication has come back to life for one special issue, an issue that seeks to address this critical moment in Baltimore's history in the wake of last spring's civil unrest. During the hour ahead, we'll talk with Urbanite former editors Lionel Foster and Elizabeth Evitz, publisher Tracy Ward, and we're also going to meet some of the contributors to this special issue, folks like activist Adam Jackson, journalist Lawrence Lanahan, and poet Carsonia Wise Whitehead. The return of the Urbanites on Midday, right after the news. Welcome to Midday. I'm Aaron Henkin, sitting in for Sheila Cass. Thanks for being with us. A little reminder here at the top of the hour, Midday is a public forum. It is your forum. It's a radio town square. It's a place for dialogue and interaction. And so before anything else, I want to first and foremost welcome you, our listeners, into the conversation during the hour ahead. Join us with your thoughts, your questions, your comments at 410-662-8780. 410-662-8780. Or you can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. If you've been here in town for a while, you'll remember seeing the big full-color covers of Urbanite magazine gracing the counters at your local pizza place or your coffee shop. This free monthly magazine covered art, politics, transportation, education, just about all aspects of life in Baltimore. Urbanite ceased production back in 2012, but the magazine is back for one special edition today, as a matter of fact, an issue titled Truth, Reconciliation, and Baltimore. It's a look at racial injustice, economic inequality, public safety, flush with ideas from Baltimore residents about how to make this city a better place. Joining me now is Urbanite publisher Tracy Ward, along with former Urbanite editors Lionel Foster and Elizabeth Evitz Dickinson. Tracy and Elizabeth are here in studio. Welcome to you both.
Hello.
And hopefully, Lionel, you're on the phone with us too. Lionel?
I'm right here. Happy to be here.
Good to have you with us. So first off, maybe we'll let Tracy begin with this, and then Elizabeth and Lionel. A brief history of Urbanite, its time and place in the Baltimore media landscape. When and how did this magazine get started? And what was the idea that inspired it?
So I have been involved in community and economic development for my entire career, over 30 years, or about 30 years. And after doing a lot of more grassroots type work, I would hear a lot from the community, the problem is the media, the problem is the media. And I always would say, no, we just need to work through the system and have the right ideas, et cetera. And over time, I started to think, you know, maybe the problem is a little bit the media, or maybe it is the media, but clearly in Baltimore, there's a gap in the media. And so at that time, which was 2003, I started to meet with Laurel Durenberger, who had a publication called Urbanite Magazine. She then moved to New Jersey, and I decided to relaunch it under Urbanite in 2004 to really, I think, start a dialogue about Baltimore, its possibilities, the issues that we confront on a daily basis, and how we might all collectively work together to solve them.
That mission, that idea was handed to you, Elizabeth Evitz Dickinson, early on. Were you the first editor there?
There was one before me, Joan Jacobson, helped launch the original issue. Mm-hmm. But I came on, I think two issues in early in 2004.
Tell me how you took that agenda and made it a reality as an editor.
Well, it was really a wonderful opportunity, obviously. Tracy and then the art director, Alex Castro, wanted to really think of how we might structure the magazine so that it would become a springboard for dialogue. So we started to think about not just reporting and strong journalism, having seasoned reporters and writers who could report stories, but also how we could bring in other voices. How could we bring in the community, our neighbors, poets, students? And so I set about with a great team to structure departments and an infrastructure within the magazine that would allow those multifarious voices to come in and talk about the city in different ways.
Lionel Foster, you picked up the baton at some point along the way as the editor at Urbanite, and talk to me about how you stepped into the breach there and what you did to continue that dialogue.
Oh, actually, you all give me too much credit. So I was staff writer during part of Urbanite's run. I was never editor then, but I'm a co-editor on the special issue.
Oh, look, I gave you a promotion. Okay.
So, but go ahead. Now, it was amazing because, you know, Urbanite's maturation coincided and helped my own. So I grew up in Baltimore, in East Baltimore, and I went away for grad school. I went to Hopkins undergrad, studied creative writing, and then studied urban policy and government policy abroad in London for 3 years from 2002 through 2005. So when I came back and was looking for a job, I found out that in the interim, there had developed this magazine that cared about good writing and the power of narrative and connecting people, but also serious policy issues. So it really brought together my passion from my undergraduate days, the things I just learned in urban planning school in London, and my hometown. And it helped me reconnect with the place I care most about. And I think it did the same thing for a lot of other folks during its run.
Lionel Foster, as a staff writer at the magazine, what are some of the pieces over the past decade that you are most proud of, that you felt were most impactful?
Yeah, I think there was, just speaking very selfishly and narrow-mindedly about one that stands out to me that I was most involved with, there was a piece called "And the Walls Came Tumbling Down," and it's where I talked about growing up in East Baltimore, in the East Baltimore Development Inc. catchment area, and coming back from a foreign country, becoming reacquainted with my family, frankly, as well as Baltimore, and seeing one of the places where I grew up, my grandmother's house at 1034 North Wolf Street, knocked down as part of that redevelopment, and having really mixed feelings about it, as I think a lot of people did. It was a troubled community, but it was also one where some things really worked and relationships really mattered. So that piece kind of helped define who I was as a writer, and I still get people who say they really appreciated it or it was meaningful to them as well.
Lionel, we're going to get into your more recent writing here in just a bit, but first a little bit more about the lifespan of Urbanite. Talk about what brought about the end of the publication, Tracy Ward.
So we launched in 2004. By 2007, rather, we were definitely on our way to break-even point. If you recall, in 2008, the market overall, the economic market in the United States, tumbled. And that forced us to make some hard decisions, make some changes, but we managed to stay on our feet. The next several years after that were very difficult, and we were unable to give raises. We were unable to make the investments in the publication that needed to be made. As you recall, the recession, as we called it, some called it a depression, lasted many more years than any of us expected. We were trying to hang in there for the economy to get better. So we reached break even, but we were still at a point where we needed substantive investment, particularly in the online side of things. So the internet, was social media in particular, was taking hold, and we needed to make significant investments there in order to really move the publication to the next level. We tried to sell it. I think at that time the marketplace was just very nervous about something, particularly a publication like this. And in the long run, we just sort of shuttered it in 2012 and called it a day.
And Elizabeth Evitz, I wonder if you might look back at the career run of the Urbanite, its place in the media landscape. I mean, you've got the Sun, you've got the City Paper. Talk about what was special about the Urbanite and maybe some of your recollections of the stories that really gave it its defining character.
Sure. I think what we always tried to do was look at sort of the bigger picture, not just of what was going on in Baltimore, but in cities in general. And we always said that this was going to be a conversation about what was happening culturally in cities, but through the lens of Baltimore. And each issue from the start always had a theme. And one of the reasons we did this was to give ourselves the opportunity to look at one topic from a multifaceted standpoint. We weren't necessarily driven by, you know, breaking news. We were trying to take a bigger look at certain issues. And looking back, you know, I realized looking at our online archive, which is still online, you can go back and look and flip through all of the issues, which is great. You know, we started talking about things like race and economics and sort of what was going on in the city as early as 2005. It was very important to us right from the beginning to try and have these more challenging conversations, but doing it in a way that could potentially foster a dialogue rather than sort of shut down that conversation.
Lionel Foster, you hear Elizabeth Evans Dickinson talking about each episode. Listen to me, radio talk. They're not called episodes, are they? They're called issues. Each issue has a theme. Talk about this new special reissue, how it came to be, and the theme that you put on it.
Yeah, so I remember it was through Facebook. Tracy got in touch with a bunch of the former staffers and said she had some seed money to see if we might want to do a special issue, and were we willing? And I think pretty much immediately everyone to a person said yes. And, you know, I live and work in Washington, D.C. now. I'm in Baltimore every other week or so. And so we were scattered all over the place. Greg Hanscom, one of the former editors, is in Seattle. But we all wanted to help when we saw what was going on in Baltimore. So when we try to think about what exactly happened and how can we give people a platform to think constructively about how to move forward, we brainstormed, we talked a lot, and the theme that came forward was truth and reconciliation. You have Ta-Nehisi Coates, an amazing writer for The Atlantic, who with his piece, The Case for Reparations in 2014, made reparations not a dirty word. It was something you could talk about, not just in intellectual circles, but mainstream, you know, polite social circles as well. So you had Ta-Nehisi in Chicago this year. Victims of police torture were given, quote, reparations. They used the R word. And I just happened to have recently read Ron Walter's book, The Case for Racial Reconciliation, where he looks at the truth and reconciliation model in South Africa. So it seemed to me with, you know, the many things and the many ways a lot of folks in Baltimore, especially black folk, have felt put down for decades, it was time for that conversation.
Lionel, we're going to get into the content of this issue right after our break, which is happening in just a minute. In the meantime, though, I have to say this is really a triumph. Tracy Ward and company, I mean, these magazines were really a fixture of, you know, the literary and journalistic landscape in Baltimore for many years. I mean, these full-color covers, the font of the urbanite across the cover, call me nostalgic, but it's not, I'm looking at the hard copy. It's coming out today.
Yes.
So it'll be like a blast from the past. You look around, you'll see these urbanite magazines today covering this theme, truth, reconciliation, and Baltimore. Before we head to the break, let me just ask, is this inspiring you guys to, like, get the gang back together? Are we going to see more special issues?
I think there are members of the urbanite team, loosely defined, that are interested in possibly doing things in the future. I've been calling this a one-off because I acknowledge and recognize what it takes, the cost of putting something like this on the street, and the fact that more than likely it'll need subsidy. I'm a big fan of supporting a group of individuals. If they want to take that on, I'd be right there behind them, supporting them. I'm doing other work on the Eastern Shore now. I probably won't personally be involved.
Urbanite publisher Tracy Ward here along with former editor Elizabeth Evitz Dickinson and staff writer Lionel Foster. Tracy, Lionel, you're going to stay with us. Elizabeth, thank you for dropping by. Farewell. We're going to hear from some more folks after a short break. When we come back, we'll get into the content of the new Urbanite with Lionel Foster and a Baltimore activist that he profiles in his article. We're happy to take your calls as well. Join the conversation at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Aaron Henkin, in for Sheila Cast. Urbanite is out today with a special issue titled Truth and Reconciliation in Baltimore. Truth, Reconciliation, and Baltimore. Urbanite staff writer and special editor Lionel Foster has an article in this edition. It's a piece titled The Case for Reconciliation. And in it, he interviews several social justice thinkers, including Adam Jackson, co-founder of the grassroots organization Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. Lionel Foster is on the phone with us, and Adam Jackson is here in studio. Gentlemen, welcome, both of you.
Thank you for having me.
So, Lionel, first let me just say, listeners, the number to call to add your voice to the conversation, 410-662-8780, or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. And Lionel, let me ask you to talk about, you had begun alluding to the historical precedents for truth commissions and remuneration. Talk about what inspired you to apply this model theoretically, this model of restorative justice, to Baltimore.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, social media was a buzz after the unrest and the riots and the protests, and there was just this outpouring of thoughts and sentiment, some of it really pain, some of it really poignant. And as I read all this and talked to people, it seemed to me that we had two very different views of what's been happening in Baltimore. I could say, as an African American, you know, you grow up from birth knowing that folks who look like you have not been fully welcomed into what we call the American dream. You know that. You live that. You see that every day. But folks who don't look like you don't necessarily have the same view on history. So what I propose to, you know, my colleagues and former colleagues at Urbanite is there a process that could help reconcile these two sometimes violently conflicting views on Baltimore's history and the present? And a truth and reconciliation process seemed like the way to do that.
Lionel, let me have you talk about the array of thinkers that you got to sound off on this subject, and by doing so, maybe introduce us to Adam Jackson.
Absolutely. So there are local and international perspectives. Canada actually just underwent a truth and reconciliation process focused on crimes against its indigenous communities. So I spoke to Marie Wilson, who was one of three commissioners who spearheaded that work. I also interviewed Sherilyn Eiffel, who's counsel general and so head of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, and she has worked in the Baltimore area for well over a decade now. And then there was Adam and Davon, co-founders of Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, and Dr. Helena Hicks, who's a veteran activist and helped desegregate lunch counters in Baltimore, I believe in the 1950s.
It's it's a multi-generational array, a multinational array of thinkers. Adam Jackson, you're here in studio with us. Let me ask you this question of truth and reconciliation. A commission was put to you by Lionel Foster of Urbanite. Is that model of restorative justice, is that something that makes sense to you?
Well, I think that in Baltimore in particular, one of the things that we don't focus on is the ways that institutional and structural racism and white supremacy has infiltrated our institutions and the way that Baltimore operates. So I think that over time, when people have saw the uprising, they saw like how the people were protesting and talking about the different things that were affecting their communities, people weren't thinking about the historical implications of what was going on in Baltimore. So like one example I always bring up is with Martin O'Malley as a good example of between 1999 and 2007, when he commissioned over 757,000 illegal arrests in Baltimore. And that mass incarceration policy and mass arrest policy led to some of the current policies that the Baltimore City Police Department currently uses. And I mean, I would say led to the death of Freddie Gray. And so to me, truth and reconciliation can only really occur if you're talking about justice, resources, and building institutions. I've been talking about these things for such a long period of time. I've been telling the truth. So we already know the truth. Let's just figure out how to actually build resources and build institutions that can protect the quality of life for Black people in Baltimore.
Adam Jackson, that you bring up a really important point here, and that is, what does it take to get beyond that immediately sort of galvanizing anger over an incidence of injustice to the longer work of, you know, addressing the laws and the policies behind it? How do you turn a moment with such potential for change into a real sustained movement that's aimed at long-term goals?
I mean, the primary thing is you need people who are of and from the community leading the effort. And I think that typically what has happened in Baltimore, we have nonprofits and foundations who are external to the community, who are not of and from our communities, controlling the agenda, controlling the protocols for how we move forward. And I think one of the things that the uprising showed us is that that historically has not worked, and that people aren't going to tolerate it, and that we need things that are actually going to get us to win. People have been profiteering off of our suffering for so long. And so to me, the step forward is how do you build communal-based black institutions that are controlled by people who are of and from the community. So I know the reason why LBS is a grassroots think tank is because in Baltimore, there is no grassroots voice in the political process when you're talking about public policy. There are nonprofits that do advocacy work, but typically those people don't represent us. They're the directors, the boards, whomever are usually white, usually not from our communities, and usually don't understand the complexities of how racism has affected our everyday life. And so that's why we're a think tank. But we think that there should be public investment and not just organizations like ours, but others that do similar types of work. And to me, that's been more effective in addressing these issues. And if we look back even further, this early this year in 2015, during the legislative session, we were advocating for police accountability reform, but no public officials would commit to act, besides Delegate Joe Carter in Baltimore, was committing to actually changing some of these policies that led to the death of Freddie Gray. And so to me, we need to have more people who are from the community in these conversations and actually getting the resources to do this type of work, because if we're actually trying to win, that's what you need to do.
Adam Jackson of Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. Lionel Foster, you got an earful from Adam Jackson, from everyone else you spoke with. I mean, what was the synthesizing takeaway that you are left with after so many interviews?
Yeah, it was an incredibly rich conversation, because I went in knowing that, you know, you hear the term truth and reconciliation. So who's going to disagree with truth, and who's going to disagree with reconciliation? They sound like such feel-good concepts, but what all of the interviewees helped me get in touch with is that it's not just about talk. And that's a direct quote from Sherrilyn Ifill with the ACP Legal Defense Fund. They brought to bear, you know, we spent centuries as a country investing in disadvantage, investing in oppression, investing in keeping certain people down. So we need to be just as vigorous and active and investing in making these communities whole, period. So that was the bottom line. And then the big question becomes, and I don't think there's any disputing that. So then the next question becomes, do we have the guts to do it? Are we ready to do it? And I think by and large, the answer was no. Especially the black people I interviewed for this piece feel like America is not there yet. My hope is that we can get there. But, you know, I let Dr. Helena Hicks have the last word in that piece. As she said, we're not ready. I may be a little more optimistic than she is, but I take that to heart.
Lionel Foster, Adam Jackson, I want to turn to the phones now. You've got some interested callers here who want to share their voice in the conversation. 410-662-8780. We go now to Marina in Baltimore. Marina, you're on the air.
Hello. This is Marina. First of all, I want to mention the fact that I'm a huge fan of Lionel, and I'm really looking forward to reading the article. And second of all, you know, when the events of April, I don't remember the dates at this point, but the events connected to Freddie Gray took place, that was my first thought, you know, knowing the history of everything that has happened in America and knowing the history of everything that happened here in Baltimore. I think instituting some sort of a commission and addressing it through justice and through some sort of legal reconciliation is the only way forward, not just for Baltimore, but also for the U.S. And I think Baltimore can be a fantastic, you know, test case or initiator of this reform for our country.
Marina, thank you very much for the call. Appreciate it. 410-662-8780, the number to call to join the conversation. Next, we're going to hear from Mike in North Baltimore. Mike, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. Hello to your guests, and I'm very interested in the conversation. I have a couple of questions for Mr. Jackson. One is just if he could reiterate his relationship with Lionel, but also in his brief comments there, he talked about with LBS winning, and I guess I'd want to ask him for him to flesh out what a win would be, because at some level I'm wondering if that's a question of you know, taking from Peter to pay Paul, which then would potentially, you know, be met with a lot of resistance.
Well, the first talk about Lionel, I've known Lionel for a few years now, and I was always a fan of his work beforehand. But when we met, Lionel was just kind of, he was just a colleague of ours. Gave us great advice on how to interact with you know, different media folks here in Baltimore, and just been a great resource and a great friend for a few years. But to answer your second question about what does winning look like, I think that most of the time when people think about social justice work, they think about people being at protests and, you know, giving temporary solutions, short-term kind of dialogue on major institutional dynamics. And I think for LBS and just for the generally speaking, the only way you can win in a racist and white supremacist society is that you have to institution build, and you need resources that are invested in those institutions to protect the quality of life of the people you're serving. And so in Baltimore, the point I was making earlier is that there are several nonprofit organizations, as an example, where people are getting paid salaries to profiteer off of black people's suffering. So nonprofits that advocate on our behalf, you know, they don't get a salary if we actually eradicate poverty. If we actually eradicate poverty, then you know, these people don't have jobs. And instead, and they use terminology like poverty eradication instead of wealth creation in the black community, which to me denotes investment instead of from a deficit model of black people needing people to come into our community. We have the institutions, we have the organizations, we have the infrastructure. The problem is people don't want to invest in it. And now we're at a place in history where that same model of relying on foundations and nonprofits who are not of and from our community won't work anymore. So to me, winning is actually getting structural transformation by investing in the people that we're claiming to serve, and so that way we can control our trajectory in the political and economic sectors of our lives.
You're tuned to Midday here on WYPR. Aaron Henkin in for Sheila Cast this hour as we get a look at the new special issue of Urbanite magazine. I guess it's just called Urbanite. A new look,
yes,
at a special new issue of Urbanite. We're going to turn now to an article here by freelance journalist and former Maryland Morning producer Lawrence Lanahan. Lawrence, this is a piece titled "Who Can Save Sandtown?" And in it, you tell a story here about a neighborhood, Sandtown, Winchester, through the lens of one of its residents, Phoebe Norfleet. Let me start by having you tell Phoebe's story, Lawrence.
Well, Phoebe lives in a house on Fulton Avenue in Sandtown, and she has a job as a housekeeper at GBMC, the hospital where I was born. It's about 6 miles away in Towson, all right? So she's got to get from Sandtown to Towson every day. Her shift starts at 6, all right? So I decided, you know, to see what it's like to scratch out a living and be part of a community like Sandtown. I got out and I rode the bus with her. We got out there about 4:30, 4:45 in the morning. It took over an hour and 15 minutes. Had to go all the way downtown and then catch another bus and go all the way up to GBMC. And she doesn't go to the bus stop. She sits on her stoop and waits till she sees the headlights, then runs across, you know, Fulton Avenue, 6 lanes.
And why is that?
Because she doesn't feel safe, and it's not maybe what intuitively you might think. She's more afraid of the police than she is of anybody else that's hanging out at 4:45 in the morning in Sandtown, because the police are coming from outside the neighborhood, and, you know, she thinks they see a black person walking around Sandtown at 5 in the morning. They don't think work. They think, you know, what might they be getting into?
Lawrence Lanahan, you call Sandtown an emblem of everything that's not working in Baltimore City. Talk about that and why that is.
Well, I think what I wanted to do is write about Sandtown, the actual community and the actual people that live there. I think the problem is that Sandtown has become more of a symbol than a real place.
Mm-hmm.
All this stuff has happened, and it's become like shorthand for dysfunction, sort of like the way The Wire has become shorthand for this sort of cynical take on, oh, all the institutions of Baltimore are messed up. So it's become the symbol of not only dysfunction, but of quote-unquote failed efforts to transform it.
Right. This article goes on to point out that, you know, despite all the good intentions and millions of dollars invested by various foundations and government agencies, and this echoes very directly what we were just hearing from Adam Jackson.
It absolutely does.
Nothing seems to change in the neighborhood. Why is that? What's not working?
Well, what happens is people have lots of great ideas from outside the neighborhood, and they come in. And what happened in the 90s, the short version is lots of money went in. It was a private-public partnership to transform the neighborhood. And sort of the people coming from the top down got impatient. You know, the foundations wanted deliverables. So they did, they had lots of brick and mortar kind of stuff, housing, that they're able to say, look what we did. But I think they got impatient with the structure of the community leadership and kind of went over it and kind of pushed things through. And then the residents got a little bit resentful because it's like, well, the results didn't turn out the way that the expectations had been built up for. So what I wanted to write about was what's already going on. Like Adam talked about, there are institutions within these neighborhoods that are already, they have this infrastructure to do this work. And the money came in for a while there in the 90s, and they did a lot of great stuff. That money started to go away. Well, they didn't go away. The neighborhood didn't go away. Mm-hmm. So they're already, they're doing the work and ready to do some more.
You present an interesting alternate case in this article. You look at the organization Newborn Holistic Ministries as a possible kind of antidote to the kinds of organizations and foundations that have failed here in the past. Talk about this place and about Elder Clyde Harris and the work that's going on there at the intersection of Pressman Street and Pennsylvania Avenue.
Sure. So there's Newborn Holistic Ministries and there's New Song Community Church. And what they've got going on there is a lot of community development efforts that are from longtime community leaders. But they also have this sort of infrastructure to bring in resources in a way that won't kind of pave over what's already going on there. They are part of this idea called Christian Community Development, which is they have these principles, which are reconciliation, which we've been talking about, racial reconciliation, which is not just, you know, interpersonal fun, racial harmony. Mm-hmm. It's the very, very difficult work of, you know, if you are a white person, you move to this neighborhood, you're taught not to call 911 like that. If you see a black guy in cuffs on the police car, you don't say, what did he do? You know, you say, what's going on? Is everything okay? You know? And so there's this deep racial reconciliation work. And then there's what's called redistribution. And it's not kind of, you know, this, you know, taking from Peter to pay Paul or whatever. It's, if you are coming, if you're black or white, middle class, coming into the neighborhood and you want to move in, and they do want you to move in, so you're part of the community you're helping, the idea is that if you have a good idea, you tap somebody as a co-director from the neighborhood. You are attached through your privilege and through the way you've grown up to resources. If you're living in the community, those resources are there too. And instead of just plowing through with your ideas, you partner with the community and you ask, you listen to the community, what can we do? And so they've got this infrastructure for people to come from outside and partner with the community in a way that doesn't kind of, I think, doesn't, you know, do what Adam's talking about, where you just come from the outside and sort of by fiat say, this is the way we're going to fix things.
Exactly.
Journalist Lawrence Lanahan, who has written a piece for the new special edition of Urbanite, a piece titled Who Can Save Sandtown. We're going to go to the break in just a minute, but first, a quick call here from George in Baltimore at 410-662-8780. George, you're on the air.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
And I'm just listening, and it just seems like I'm 59 years old. I saw the riots when I was 12, and it just seems like after the riots, it just seems like everyone comes in and they figure, okay, well, we'll give some money and we'll get some housing and we'll set up jobs and everything will be fine, and it's not fine. It's not fine. I think it's we have a responsibility as people, as community, black people, to make things better than what they are. Not expect that at any time. All they have to do is give us more things, give us more money, and we'll be better people. I've seen it, and we don't. Racism and white supremacy are no threats to me. Or let me put it like this. Let me restate that. They're like fourth or fifth on my list. What fears me the most is the violence in our neighborhoods and the fact that we're the first to die in Baltimore in January and the last to die in December. I mean, and that gets overshadowed by the fact that we say we should have more, we need more. If only we had this and that, we'd be in a better place. I can't name, and 9 out of 10 people, black people that I would walk to, and I'm gonna be quiet, couldn't name a racist incident that happened to them. I bet you, in the last 30 days, because it's not that frequent. Every time you step out or you go out, someone's doing something racist to you. A lot of people use it as an excuse that they don't like, they say, oh, that's racist, or it's because of racism that I didn't get that opportunity. But it's not always that. Sometimes it's our responsibility, and we need to take our responsibility and take back our neighborhoods and our communities.
Sure.
And watch out for our children, and don't let them do the things that they do.
George in Baltimore, we hear you loud and clear. Adam Jackson from Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, I'm going to let you respond to that.
Yeah, I mean, my only response would be that, I mean, I think on the one hand, yeah, personal responsibility is always important. I think that that's what I'm talking about is just that. People already have organizations and institutions. The issue is that we don't see, because I think that what George is talking about is interpersonal, individualized racism, and what I'm talking about is more of a structure and institution and how it's set up to keep black organizations and black institutions from actually protecting black people and improving the quality of life for our own people. And so I think what we need is investment and seed capital so that we can actually grow and institutions that protect our folks. But and the thing is, the civil rights, because he talked about the riots, one of the primary force behind the civil rights movement was the fact that we were able to build institutions that were able to protect the lives of our people. You don't have the legislation that people championed during that time frame. You don't have a lot of the leaders you have today if it was not for the institutions that protected those folks and build up those folks to actually create the better quality of life. So I think at this point, we need to focus on how we can actually build up communal-based institutions in Baltimore that can actually protect us. Because if we're relying on the government to do it, then we're going to be waiting for Superman.
Adam Jackson of Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, thank you, sir. Lawrence Lanahan, journalist contributor to this new special edition of Urbanite, thank you both.
Thanks, sir.
We're going to take a short break here, and in a moment we're going to hear from poet and mother, Carsonia K. Whitehead. She's contributed a piece called Songs in a Key Called Baltimore. You're most welcome to join the conversation as well, 410-662-8780, or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Aaron Henkin, in for Sheila Cast. Urbanite is back today, as a matter of fact, with a special return issue titled Truth, Reconciliation, and Baltimore. It's got some really thoughtful and well-reported articles about racial injustice and economic inequality in our city, articles and poetry as well. On that note, joining us now is Carsonia K. Wise Whitehead. She is a professor of African and African American Studies and Communications at Loyola University. She's also a mom, and she has written a poem for this special issue, a poem titled Songs in a Key Called Baltimore. And Kay, first of all, welcome.
Thank you so much for inviting me back to the show.
I wonder if I can ask you to read this poem for us.
I would love to read this poem for you. I would like to write a song about peace, about reconciliation, about a city coming back together and working for the common good. I would like to proclaim that Black Lives Matter and then point to the ways in which this simple concept, screamed and shouted, cried over and prayed about, has transformed the city and altered our space. I would like to teach my sons about peace, even though I am raising them in a city where peace has never been the norm, where peace is not taught on the playground, nor practiced in the school, nor modeled on the street corner. I try and hide my frustration because in the aftermath of the uprising, a time when Black and white people named their pain, life has settled back down to the familiar, to a time where Black bodies are once again in danger, Black life is once again criminalized, and Black spaces exist once again only in the edges of both the city and our minds. I am not old enough to remember life before Brown v. Board, when Black and white spaces were clearly marked, and I suspect, though, that it was not much different than it is now in places around Baltimore and places across America where the crime of breathing while Black is still punishable by death. My heart always skips a beat when a cop's car is behind me when I'm driving at night. And though my sons are not old enough to drive, I'm already frightened, concerned, angry, frustrated as I think about the day when they will be stopped for the crime of driving while Black. There are days when being a Black mother in America overwhelms me and makes me want to spend the day in bed, and times when being the Black mother of Black boys in Baltimore City makes me wish I had enough money to move them somewhere where I can keep them safe. Safe from them, the ones who see their lives expendable and unnecessary. And safe from us, those who look at them without realizing that they are mirrors that simply reflect all of who we are supposed to be. I often think about slavery and how different life was when you can see the hand that held the chain that was attached to the ball that was tied to your ankle. We come from a people who experienced this daily and still chose to survive. Survival is our legacy.
Kay Wise Whitehead, reading her poem, Songs in a Key Called Baltimore. An excerpt, I should say. It goes on from there. I wonder, Kay, if you might talk to me about the conversations that you have with your sons about racism, about police brutality. How hard is it to have those conversations, and how important?
Well, it's very difficult for my husband and I. We have always thought that the world that my father helped to create as an activist during the civil rights movement and the world that I grew up in, where either I was completely unaware of what was happening in and around the city or things had actually changed. I thought my sons were going to be protected from that. We thought we could make enough money to send them to schools where they wouldn't have to deal with that. We'd move to a good neighborhood where they'd never have to look back. And when Trayvon Martin was killed, my husband and I realized it was time to have that talk with our sons. In white households, that talk is about safe sex. It's about making good choices. In a household raising two black boys, that talk is about what do you do when the cops stop you? What do you do when you're followed in the store? What do you do when a fight breaks out in the playground? The racial talk that we had always tried to avoid, we had to have. So my boys have been actively involved in this conversation since then, and they have picked up the mantle of activism in their own lives.
In this poem that you've just read, that you've contributed to Urbanite, you say survival is our legacy. Say more about that. What survival has meant for black lives in America in centuries past compared to what it means now?
Well, I'm a historian, and I study African-American history. So when I think about survival, I think of what it must have been like for the first 20 Africans to come into the shore in 1619 and to be in a new place, a new land, and make that decision to want to survive. I believe survival is an everyday choice. I think about my ancestors who were enslaved in South Carolina. They chose to survive, and they chose to keep going. And here we are in 2015. I am choosing, along with my husband, to survive. We're choosing to create a better world for our sons. We're choosing to get them involved in activism. We're choosing ways to help them become better people, to be true to who they are. So every day, I think that when we think about who we are and the places where we exist, you have to make that choice. And survival is an active choice, to be an active present agent in your own life.
What is the world you imagine for your sons a generation from now, maybe when they're your age? Is there any reason to hope that our society's needle is going to move away from racial injustice?
There is. Hope is what gets me up in the morning. Yeah. There's no way that I can raise two black boys in Baltimore City and not have hope that things are going to change. If I was that frustrated, if I was that unhappy, if I was that pessimistic, then I would move out of this city. But I believe there's something special in Baltimore City. It's my new adopted home. We've only been here 10 years. But for my sons, this is the only home that they have ever known. So when Freddie Gray died, they said to me, Mommy, we have to do something. This is our city. We have to make it better. So a generation from now, I think that when my grandkids are hopefully taking a look at this Urbanite that will sit on our coffee table for years to come, that they will look and think, you know, Grandma did something great. She made this city better. Now, what can we do to carry the mantle a little bit farther? I don't think, as Dr. King said, when you talk about that old arc of justice, that it is still moving and it hasn't gotten there yet, but the goal is to push it towards justice a little bit more. That is what I want to do.
Carsonia K. Wise Whitehead, a poet who has contributed here to the special one-time reissue of Urbanite. Also sitting in the studio with us here is Urbanite publisher Tracy Ward. Tracy, talk about the importance and the place of poetry in this publication, this issue in particular, maybe, and in the past.
Well, I don't know how you feel, but I can certainly say I feel very moved by hearing Kay's poem. Right from the beginning, when I was concepting Urbanite, I started to look at what I admired in other publications, not just local publications, but national publications. One of the things that I felt was critically important, and as the staff assembled and my business partner, then business partner Alex Castro, came on board, we all knew and felt strongly that fiction, poetry, art, great art, these are all other avenues for having a dialogue, being able to be moved in ways that sometimes we can't put words to. So Urbanite, right from the beginning, had a commitment to the arts, and the publication itself was always a beautiful, beautiful thing. The artists that we invited to be a part of Urbanite always put forth their best work. We always went to them and said, we're not asking you to do what you do for other publications. We're asking you to do your best artwork that you do for yourself.
Kay, I wonder if you've had an opportunity to look through at some of the other poems that share these pages with your work.
I have. I looked at it online, and I was just so moved. I started my career as a poet many years ago, so to come back around to my first love and to have it in Urbanite, for me, a magazine I've always wanted to be a part of. I used to read Urbanite when I was a school teacher here in Baltimore City, and I would make my students bring it to school, and we would go through it sometimes article by article. It was always a dream for me to be in it. So to be in this, you know, one edition special on one of the most important issues that we're struggling with at this time is absolutely amazing for me.
You know, we've got just a few minutes here before the end of the program, I guess I can use that time to congratulate you, Tracy Ward, on this publication and for finding such a great array of contributors. I do have an email here from someone who wants to know where do they find this thing? Where is the Urbanite? Where is Urbanite today? It comes out today. Where do they find?
So people should go to www.urbanitebaltimore.com, and you can click on a link there. It'll give you a full list of locations. I would say that if you remember where you used to pick it up, more than likely you're going to find publications at that same location. I also just want to really quickly say a big shout out to the people that supported the issue, the foundations, private donations, and also the advertisers, because it took a certain amount of courage to step up and be a part of this issue. And so please pay attention to those partners, because they're very important to all of us.
Once again, I want to thank our special guest this segment, Carsonia K. Wise Whitehead. She's a professor of African and African-American Studies and Communications at Loyola University. Her poem, out today in the special return edition of Urbanite, is titled Songs in a Key Called Baltimore. Kay, thanks for sharing that poem, and thanks for being
with
us.
Always a pleasure.
Thanks also this hour to our other guests, Urbanite publisher Tracy Ward, Urbanite former editor Elizabeth Evitz Dickinson, editor of this special issue, and staff writer Lionel Foster. Lionel, you still on the phone, by the way?
I'm right here.
Look at you. You've been listening quietly this whole time. Thank you so much for being with us. Thanks also to Adam Jackson of Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, and to journalist Lawrence Lanahan. The new Urbanite, it's out today, and it is free. Take a look around your local pizza place, your local coffee shop. Give it a read. It is well worth your while. Thanks also to The Diz for supplying lunch today for our midday guests. The Diz is located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington. It features signature burgers, wings, steaks, and jumbo lump crab cakes. It's open for lunch and dinner with breakfast served weekends on the web, thedizbaltimore.com. Tomorrow on Midday, we're going to talk transportation with, going to look at Governor Hogan's CityLink plans for Baltimore, urban design, et cetera, et cetera. For Sheila Cast and Midday, I'm Aaron Henkin. Thanks for listening. Midday's producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producers are Melody Simmons and Connor Graham. The Midday intern is Adam Droneberg. Midday's engineer is Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.